possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
It's 12:37. High pressure over Michigan will shift to the east today, allowing a southerly flow to resume across the region. With a warm front tracking northward across the Midwest, showers and thunderstorms will track across Missouri and portions of Illinois and Iowa today. Once the front pulls further north, we'll see a return of hot and humid weather. High temperatures today will range from the mid-60s across northeastern Wisconsin to the mid-90s across southeastern Missouri. Overnight low temperatures will range from the low 50s across northeastern Wisconsin to the low 70s across southeastern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 78. The wind from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 64 and a southeast wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and warmer, the high 92. The wind will be from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night, mostly clear with a low of 72 and a light southwest wind. Saturday, mostly sunny, the high in the low 90s. Saturday night and Sunday, partly cloudy with a low Saturday night in the upper 60s and a high Sunday in the mid 80s. And the outlook for Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid 60s to the mid 80s. Rockford reported 66 degrees, as did Bloomington. It was 65 at O'Hare, 70 at Mattoon. Carbondale reported 85 degrees. At South Bend, 68, 74 at Lafayette, 75 at both Indianapolis and Terre Haute. And at noon, Willard Airport reported 69 degrees with a dew point of 61, the relative humidity 75%, the wind out of the east at 6, and the barometric pressure 30.19 and falling. And at 12:39, 69 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois, the sky is cloudy. As scientists work to figure out the world, they often turn back the clock to understand the beginnings of things. The Big Bang, patient zero, the chicken or the egg. In the latest installment of our public radio science experiment, Gabriel Spitzer considers the beginning of new species and of consciousness itself. Its origin stories on Clever Apes.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Clever Apes. Science organizes the living world into categories: kingdom, genus, species. It's a bedrock of the life sciences, going back at least to Aristotle. That tradition has guardians, and Bill Stanley is one of them.
Let's go up these stairs here.
His domain is several floors of metal cabinets, but just one row, here in the inner sanctum, has locks.
There are only 5 keys in the building that can open these cases.
Stanley manages the Field Museum's mammal collection.
If a fire broke out in this building, these are the specimens here that I would rescue before any others.
These specimens are called holotypes. Each is the standard, the prototype of the species new to science, chosen when the species was first named. The idea is they stay here forever, so scientists can always learn more about the species and where it fits in, or sometimes show it's not a new species after all. Inside the cases are more than 500 mammal skins, skulls, and pickled specimens. Shrews, bats, hedgehogs, the caramel-colored skin of the original Florida panther. And one species here effectively rewrote the textbooks on African primates, not once, but twice.
This specimen is the only existing specimen of Runguaecebus kipungi.
This one is near and dear to Stanley's heart. Its story began in Tanzania in 2003. Stanley's friend Tim Davenport, a wildlife conservationist, had been hearing locals talk about this monkey, kipungi.
People in that area do have a number of spirit animals, so we actually assumed it must be a spirit animal.
He and his team began to seek out kipungi on the off chance it was real. Then one day, high in a tree on Mount Rungwe, he spotted it.
It was more shock than anything else, I think. It was fairly obvious that it was something quite different. The crest on the head, the crest on the whiskers.
It has a distinctive call, what biologists describe as honk bark. Davenport snapped a picture and, on that basis, named Lophocebus scipungi, a new species among a group of monkeys called mangabeys. Then, 2 years later, a local farmer called Davenport with the body of a dead scipungi.
My first reaction was I need to get in touch with Bill. The first thing I did was send him a message.
I was visiting the island of Mafia off the coast of Tanzania, and I got a text message on the edge of this soccer pitch where I was standing because it was the only place I could get phone reception. And I actually received 5 text messages, and they were all from Tim saying, "You've got to get to Mbeya. We have a specimen of a scipungi." It was one of the most significant days of my life.
The body was a slim, black-faced juvenile with big front teeth and a mohawk. Stanley brought it to Chicago and sent samples off for DNA analysis. The results floored him. This was no mangabey. The genes were closer to a completely different monkey, the baboon. The appearance said one genus, the molecules said another.
We can't shoehorn it into any existing genus of primate, so we had to name a new genus of primate. And this is the first time in almost a century that this has been done for African monkeys.
There are hundreds of primate species, but just dozens of genera. That would be genuses. Now, this may seem like hair-splitting, but Kipunji's exact taxonomy has real implications. Some African monkeys carry the precursor to the virus that causes AIDS. Understanding how the bug works in wild animals could be crucial to curing the disease. So you need a good map of species and genera. And that, says Tim Davenport, means you need the holotypes.
People were critical when we first described the species that that wasn't right because we didn't have a specimen. And of course they were right. Once we had the specimen, it was only then we could show that it wasn't a Lophocebus.
The naming of animals carries deep meaning in human history, and not just to science. It stretches all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where Adam's first job was to name the beasts of the earth. So this collection, for a guy like Bill Stanley, is holy ground.
I very much think of it as a sacred ritual, if you will, of applying a name to a given species. I also think of the entire type collection as an eternal flame. I really do. I think that there's a flame that we need to keep lit because we never prove anything in science. We are constantly testing a hypothesis.
So, by the light of that flame, the science goes on. At some point, one of those species evolved the ability to think and plan. Malcolm McIver has a theory on the origin of consciousness. He teaches in the engineering school at Northwestern University, and his theory goes back to our ancestors in the primordial ocean.
Life was very watery. Our vertebrate ancestors were swimming around, eating each other, learning how to sense things, and at some point, around 350 million years ago, they come up on land, and a huge change occurs in terms of how far they're able to see. And that's kind of a central point here, is that in water, your ability to see is greatly limited on the order of tens of meters. And that means that they're entering a whole new tableau of threats and opportunities every second or two. So you have to have a nervous system which is very, very reactive and very fast so that you can either get away quickly from some looming predator or launch yourself very rapidly at some looming prey.
Your nervous system is going to be geared more towards something like reflex than like thinking.
It's very much like the situation of the last time you drove in a fog. If you see something looming, you're going to have to jam down on the brakes or steer rapidly. You're not going to have time to sort of think, okay, shall I, exit 2 kilometers ahead? You're not sensing that far out.
Okay, so we begin to sprout legs, flopping out of the water a little bit, sort of making little forays on the land. How does that change the way that we sensed?
We can sense potentially much, much, much further out. Just think of a cat stalking an antelope. They could see out on the savannah, see where the antelope is. They can think of, shall I go up to this ridge of bushes, or should I make a beeline for the antelope? Significant pressure to sort of disconnect sensory input from movement would really be present in such a scenario. And so if you define consciousness a certain way, namely as thinking about possible futures, here's where natural selection can really get some traction.
So by this formulation, that's the birth of consciousness. All of a sudden, this big expansion in what you're able to see.
Well, this is a very particular definition of what consciousness is. We can talk about it in this way, but you know, we do have to be clear about what we mean here.
So if land dwellers had this big, you call it a sensorium. Is that a real word? Did you make that up? Okay. So being a field of what you're able to see, sense, and perceive. So if expanding the horizon of what we're able to see was such a sea change in how our nervous systems and our brains evolved, can you then follow that out further? I mean, what if there were another expansion, either from further evolution or from technology, that expanded our sensorium again?
This is something I think is really fascinating for us to think about as a species. You know, we're entering this time of great global climate change and possibly crisis. We would potentially benefit from being, in some sense, more conscious.
Taking a longer view.
Exactly. You can think of this time-wise or space-wise. So what if we cross that gap with, for example, artificial retina technology streaming inputs from a distant source? Thinking about the ways in which we're limited by our evolutionary past, I think might be suggestive of ways in which we could either use technology or cultural accessories.
Malcolm McIver works at the intersection of neuroscience and engineering. And with that, our origin story comes to a close. With production help from Michael DeBonis, I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
PTSD and depression are just a few of the mental illnesses that many young offenders bring into juvenile hall, but treatment has rarely been part of the juvenile justice system until recently.
The word is going out into the ranks of probation officers that this is a good thing. Utilize these services.
Mental health treatment for juvenile offenders, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM.